welcome back to another setting up for the Pacture feature. And if you have a fabulous cast, your film is available a lot of places. We'll tell us later. Best Laid Plans, Michael LeCastre is here. Welcome.
How are you, Simon? Thank you for having me on.
I'm excellent. I'm glad we could finally do this. I want people to know this took us forever to get organized.
It did, yes. It really did. And it's just, it's weird how timing works out. Like, I know for me, I run two separate businesses, and I know you've got a lot of stuff going on. So, yeah, it did take us a while, but I'm very happy to be here.
So let's start at the beginning. You've written this, you've directed this, and you starred it.
Yeah, and I produced it as well.
Who has time for that? Like, literally, that is a lot of lifting.
It was. I mean, I can tell the story. Am I allowed to swear? I don't know what
you
the
can
rules
are. Do whatever you need to do.
Okay. So basically, so I've been making films since 2008, I want to say. Like, it's been a long time. And so I've done about 12, 13 shorts. This was my first feature. And so basically, I mean, the two important things are, like, I love having that level of creative control, but also it was a complete necessity. Because the rough thing about this industry, and it's obviously going through a ton of sea changes right now, unless you live under a rock, you're somewhat aware of what's going on. But nobody is going to give you money to make your first feature. It's just, it's not going to happen. It doesn't matter who you are. Unless you're a Lucas or a Spielberg or something, like, unless you don't need the money, nobody's going to give it to you. And the other thing is that people in the industry are more likely to take you seriously if you have a completed feature. And so basically, I went to film school. I graduated from UCF with a degree in film. I did my concentration in screenwriting. And after that, I was working on shorts and doing a lot of different things. And I wrote this script about my frustration because I graduated into that Great Recession that a lot of us, I'm sure, remember pretty well. And so being a college student at the time, that was a recent graduate, that was particularly disheartening. And so after that, I was in Florida for a little bit, and then I moved to New York for a little while, figuring that it would be an easier way to advance my career. And I quickly found out that that is not true at all. And the best way I can describe that to people is it's sort of like looking at a house on a hill far away. And you're like, if I can just get closer, I can get inside. And what you don't realize is there's gates you can't see from far away. But once you get close, you can see the gates, and the gates are way taller than you've initially, you know, thought about. And we had a family friend over for dinner one night, because I was staying with my aunt and uncle at the time. And he works in the industry as a line producer. And I remember asking him, because it became quickly apparent to me that I was going to have to make a feature on my own. And so I asked him, I was like, if you called in every favor, and mind you, you've seen the film, it's a low budget movie. It's not something that needed to be, like, ridiculously over the top. It was a very inexpensive, relatively speaking, film to make. So I asked him, I was like, if you called in every favor, how much would it cost us to make this film here in New York? He was like, every favor. And I was like, every favor. And he was like, you're looking at $100K minimum. And I slammed my hand down on the table and said, and I quote, fuck that, I'm going back to Florida. Because I can make this movie for 10 grand. I can make this movie for 10 grand there. And that's exactly what we did. Production was 10 grand. The post-prod was 2.5. So the completed film was $12,500, which if you, again, you don't even have to be an expert about making movies. That's the bagel budget of a Marvel film. Like, it's nothing. And so we made a movie for very, very little money. I called in a lot of favors from family members and friends and things like that. And so I did all of those things because if I didn't do them, nobody else was going to. And so it very much, like, I enjoyed it. I don't mind that heavy lift because when I write a script, I'm very protective of it. But at the same time, like, if I didn't do those things, nobody else was going to. So, and I had a specific vision and a specific story I wanted to tell. I wrote the character of Kevin with me in mind. I was always going to play Kevin. That was the one part we didn't hold auditions for. Because, you know, I act, write, direct, and produce. I do it for theater as well. And I'm also a stand-up comic. So I know my voice. And I know what I'm good at. And I know what I'm not. And so I tend to write characters that, you know, play to my strengths. But yeah, so much of that was just necessity. So I know that was kind of a long-winded answer, but I hope that it, that kind of answered your question about
excellent
how.
Excellent answer. So, wow. I want to write, you have very distinct characters. Yourself, you play a distinct character. Your two buddies are a distinct character.
Yes.
The person you go to visit is a very distinct character.
Yeah.
Now, when you were writing that, obviously you're writing directors, you had auditions, so you didn't know who was going to play these parts, that is what I'm saying.
No, I didn't. What helped was the two – so obviously Kevin is based on me. The two main other characters besides myself, Alan and John, are based on two friends of mine from high school. So I had initially wrote it with them being in the picture. That's what I wanted. And neither of them were able to commit. So what was helpful was the guy who played John, Keith, the tall guy, is a really good friend of mine. And so I knew when we were making this movie that he was going to be involved in some way. Initially, we were going to have him play Tommy. And once my friend John, who was the inspiration for that character, kind of dropped out, I was like, well, you know, we needed somebody who was physically kind of big. And Keith's a tall guy. So I was like, I got to move you and we'll have somebody else come in. But yeah, it helped that a lot of the characters, or at least the three main ones, were based on myself and people I knew. So it was easier for me to write them. The other thing is, we all know a Tommy Booth. We all went to school with a guy like that. And so he's kind of an amalgamation of a number of people I've known throughout the years. But yeah, his voice was pretty easy for me to find. And then once Brian came in, he crushed that part so well. And he was so good. Because it's, you need somebody who can be a douche, but is still likable. And that's a very tight kind of tightrope to walk. And I thought he did a really good job at still making him relatable while still being smug. So, but yeah, the three main ones were based on, you know, myself and people I know.
I thought so. You have very fast moving dialogue, and I find that works. Because I'm going to have to ask, how much did you practice? I mean, I know you know the words, but those guys and you seem like a real conversation with friends. I really felt you guys had known each other for 100 years.
Okay.
But the dialogue moves, and I'm like, these guys have practiced. At least I would say you have.
We rehearsed a lot via Zoom, and we had to. The reason for, I mean, there are a couple of things to keep in mind here. One, like I was just saying, Keith is a real friend of mine, so I had no problem conversing with him naturally. David, the actor who played Alan, not a friend of mine, didn't know him beforehand. So, and that was just me directing him and kind of getting him to where he needed to be. But no, we rehearsed a lot. And I mean, there's a couple reasons for that. I mean, obviously you want people to know their lines, but like, I'm a big fan of like Kevin Smith and David Mamet, and they're both kind of known for their fast-paced dialogue. For a comedy, that's kind of something you want. There is nothing that will make a comedy unfunnier than it dragging, than the pace being too slow. And so the pace being kind of quick was important. Not saying that every comedy needs to be like this, but this was something that was so dialogue driven and it was so much built around the conversations that if it was a 90-minute movie, I don't think it would be as funny. I think it might have dragged a little bit. Like, one of the things that I really love is, you know, I always tell people, like, Borat is an 80-minute movie. And I'm funny, but I'm not as funny as Sacha Baron Cohen. Like, so Airplane, one of arguably possibly the funniest movie ever made, is an 80-minute movie. I'm not better than Abrams and Zucker. So, like, there's a level of keeping yourself in check and kind of realizing that, oh, I'm not going to go over – like, if those guys could do it in 80 minutes, I'm not going to overstay my welcome. The other thing is the stand-up in me knows better. Like, you don't want to overstay your welcome on stage. So, like, that, you know, all of those things together really inspired the pacing. But we rehearsed a lot. You know, and it was helpful because Keith and I have theater backgrounds. So in a lot of ways, it almost felt like rehearsing a play. And I kind of like that. I like that because it allows you to focus. You know, I'm not Michael Bay. I don't blow things up. I make my own version of Kevin Smith movies. It's people talking about things. And so my strengths as a writer and director are on character and dialogue. That's what I'm good at. That's what I know how to do. So, but I do tightly rehearse people. Yeah. So, because it needed to be, there was so much talking. So.
Okay. I want to go back to the diner scene for a second.
Sure.
I will get into a bit more of the diner in a second.
Absolutely.
This chicken finger and fries and a white Russian.
Yep.
Is that a normal order for you?
It is not an order. That actually, my buddy Steve, actually did that. That was a real thing. He did it Buffalo Wild Wings. And me and a bunch of friends, he was with us. He went out and he did that because he thought it would be funny. And it was. And I've got a pretty good memory. So, and it was one of those things I was like, make a note, like put that in a script someday. So that did really happen, but it was not me who did it. It was another friend.
Just the way you look like when you ordered it, that you were just like, yep, that's what I order every time. Like, it didn't even occur to me you would not be eating that.
Yeah. No, and that's kind of the – Kevin is – I like to say Kevin is me with no guardrails. Like, he's me amped up several things. It really happened. The wild thing is there were a lot of things in that movie that actually happened. That was a real thing that happened. The bruise scene, that whole thing where he's talking about the bruise, that really happened to me. I fell outside of a friend's apartment. Actually, cause I was chasing after Steve, we were messing around and I was chasing after because he said something that pissed me off and he knew I was going to like punch him in the arm or something. And the ground was wet, but none of us knew. And the treads on my shoes were terrible. And I fell and I got up and I had that bruise on my knee and I was like, you've got to be kidding me. So there's a lot of little stories in there. The Call of Duty thing was something I overheard. So like there's a lot of little things that happened to me and my friends that are in that film.
I'm gonna make me jump around a bit here, but I will just for this. Chocolate chip cookie reference, is this to anybody special?
No, not offhand. I just thought it would be funny to have a scene in which they're discussing committing a somewhat serious crime and then have it punctuated by them eating cookies. Like one of the running themes of the film is the fact that these guys are doing something that they're not supposed to be doing. And I don't mean legally. I mean, they're fish out of water. They're trying to do something criminal, but they are the least criminal people on the planet.
Oh, I agree.
And so that's, you know, that's part of the fun of the movie is kind of watching them bumble through. And I just thought that that would be a fun button to put on a scene. That'd be a fun way to end it.
Just because we're down this rabbit hole, my last thing. A reserve Miss Daisy.
Oh, the reverse Miss Daisy?
I have never heard of this in my life. So is this a real thing?
Not that I know of. I just thought that would be, again, that was just another thing where I had the joke and I was just like, yeah, this is funny.
Oh, it made me laugh. But I'm like, is there such a thing as this?
It might be. I've never tried it. If somebody has, God bless. Like, I make no judgments. But I, you know, to my knowledge, it's not. It wouldn't surprise me if somebody had, though.
Okay. Music. Who did you do your own music? Who helped you out?
No, my friend Ross Solana, who my roommate from film school, actually was nice enough to do the score for us. He ended up doing that. And it was I was really happy because like that was something like I play the piano and I play the drums, but that was one thing that I knew I didn't want to do for this. I was like, I'm not scoring it on top of everything else. That's too much. Like there's ambitious and then there's plain out batshit. And I was like, I'm going to cross that line if I try and score it. But no, a friend of mine did the music. And he did, I think, a really good job.
Shooting at night in an alley, how was that? You shot so many short films, it must have been easy for you.
Actually, no. So here's the thing. In theory, it would be easy. The problem with that alley, so we were in Tampa where we shot that. And the thing about the city of Tampa is, and here's some advice to filmmakers, don't bother getting permits. It's not worth it because most cities will not give them to you. They are just, if you're lucky, like the city of Orlando was wonderful. We're wonderful about that. And I made a lot of shorts in Orlando, but yeah, Tampa, they don't like to hand them out. They're real antsy. Like unless you're like, you've got a lot of money, they don't really do it. So I knew we were going to have to shoot guerrilla and shoot without permits. And we had scouted out months before. We had driven around Tampa, my friend Tyler and I, and we were just looking for anybody that would talk to us. Because we knew we were not going to be able to pay for location. And that's the thing. None of those locations we paid for. They were all friends and family for the most part. So the tricky thing about that was we shot behind a cigar shop and they were wonderful. But there was a restaurant across the street and a lady had come over from that restaurant saying that they actually owned the whole lot, even though it was not part of their restaurant, that they owned the lot across the street and that we needed to be done. Thankfully, we had more or less gotten everything we needed. So we were able to quickly kind of move on. But yeah, and that's another thing where like the rehearsal really comes in. For me, the tricky thing about that was the guy who played the pimp is my buddy Ed, who's a wonderful comedian, though he's retired from that now. But he was having a lot of trouble with his lines. And so I was having to get him because he would get nervous. And then I, you know, so I was having to help him kind of focus and just calm him down. I didn't yell or anything. I was just like, you know, you got this. We can do it. You know, I was able to kind of land the plane safely there. But it definitely was – most of the shoot – wasn't as tricky as that nighttime alley sequence, just because you're dealing with other people's space. And again, we thought we had the necessary permissions and we found out we didn't. So if it wasn't for that, the other thing too, is the scene with the drug dealer was you'd think would be easy. That guy gave us permission to shoot there. And as the night went on, he got more belligerently drunk and got really mad. And he called the person who set it up, one of my PAs, to help. And we heard him screaming on the phone at her, but he was so loud that we could hear him from inside the building at the same time. And it was particularly stressful because it was the night of the 2016 election. And so it seared into my brain. But yeah, other than those two shoots, for the most part, you know, it was easy. I would say a really important lesson to filmmakers is shoot in places you have access to. You know, if it's friends' house, your house, families, their homes, their businesses, shoot in locations where you can control. Control is everything. You need to be able to cordon people off, tell them not to come in. So the more control you have over your location, the easier your shoot's going to be. So I hope these answers aren't too long. I'm trying to, you know,
no, they're fabulous.
Give people as much information as I can.
It's your interview. You do what you want to do. Okay, we're going back to the locations. I want to discuss the restaurant because, I mean, this looks like a real happening restaurant. So when did you have time to shoot
it? It is a real restaurant. My uncle co-owns the place. So he's a business partner in the restaurant. So that was how we were able to get access. If he had said no, we would have had to find another spot. That would have been a lot trickier. But thankfully he was up for helping us. And so, yeah, it looks real because it's a real location. No sets were built. No sets were built at all in any way, shape or form for this film. They're all real locations.
Okay. So the warehouse is a real warehouse. Cause I was trying to figure out, is it a warehouse or back of like a hardware store?
Oh no, it's a real warehouse. That again, my uncle owns. So like my uncle and my dad share the space. They're all real locations.
How's the graffiti wall? Where did you find it?
So that was behind the bike shop where we shot with the guy that I was just saying who got belligerently drunk. Like that was just another thing. We went around Tarpon Springs in that area. And we were just looking for, you know, like a visually kind of distinct place where a dealer might hang out. We wanted something cool on the wall and we just happened to find it. There was definitely a lot of location scouting and kind of pounding the pavement for anything that was exterior. The interiors I had pretty much more or less, I knew what we could do, but the exteriors was a lot of asking favors of people who I did not know. So
That's indie filmmaking, just expect it.
Yeah. No, it really is.
Okay. Character names, Danny DeVito, Arnold Schwarzenegger, Ice Cube.
Yeah.
Why these names?
Because I kind of thought that, like, it would be fun, especially because, so DeVito was kind of my in-joke to myself that that's who I looked like. And then the buddy from high school, one does look like Ice Cube, and the other one looks like the other guy. So that's what, you know, he was big. So that's why I was like, yeah, it's, you know, it would be funny. So, and it makes even more sense if you had a picture of the two guys who it was written for. They look even more like those people. So, yeah, that's why those names.
Okay. How did you know about the dolphins?
Oh, man. Either I saw that on a nature show somewhere or someone told me about it. But I remember being very surprised because, like, you don't expect that from Flipper. And dolphins are mean as fuck. They really are. A lot of people are like, oh, there's a, no, Flipper's a dick. They are incredibly aggressive when they want or feel the need to be. So, yeah, that's how I found that. And it was just another one of those things that was, like, seared into my head. And my mind, I remember stuff like this. And then I end up putting it in scripts later, which is, I think, how writers write.
So how much fun was it putting pranks at the end of the film?
Oh, I mean, I loved doing that warehouse sequence. It was a lot of fun, but it was also tense because that was the last day of shooting. And we shot that entire warehouse sequence in a day. Exactly. And it was a massive, right? Like, and you can't tell when you, you know. And that's why, for the love of God, I'm hoping somebody gives me money to make another feature. Because it's like, if you knew what I could do for 12 and a half and you saw how smooth, like, how we made that work, imagine what I could do with 50 or 100. But yeah, I mean, we shot the whole last third of the movie in a day. And again, wow. I don't think it feels like that when you watch it.
No, definitely does not.
But, you know, we had tight budget and a tight shooting schedule. And I funded the entire thing out of pocket as far as production. So that was me. So, like, we pushed as hard as we could. We had 8 days to shoot in it. And I think we shot it in 7 or 8. But we were coming up on the end of the time that we had. So, and our DP is really good, and he was in demand then. He's even more in demand now. So, we definitely got him at the right time, but, and he, you know, he gave us a really good deal, because he knew it was an indie movie. And really all of the crew did it. I'm eternally thankful for that. I think it has to do with the fact that they really liked the script. You know, I'm lucky that everybody who read the script, including the casting director who got Linnea Quigley and Ed Neal, involved into the film. Everybody who read the script really liked it. And I was very lucky that people were like, oh, this is funny and fun. I think if you're an indie filmmaker and you're trying to get people to do something for little or no money, having a good script goes a long way because people are dying for that. They are dying to be part of a project they think is fun. And so if you give them something fun to play with, you'd be amazed. You know, people will flex for you in ways you won't think they will initially.
Okay. Before I let you go, I have three fun questions.
Sure.
Favorite film?
Oh, man. So I'm going to answer this as a dual split. I think the best movie ever made is Casablanca. My favorite is Clerks because of what it means to me. When I say Kevin Smith changed my life, I literally mean Kevin Smith changed my life. You know, if you do comedy, like, Kev's kind of the last guy who started off as a civilian who didn't have, you know, those big Hollywood connections, and, you know, hangs out with Ben Affleck now and stuff. I can't really think of anybody who's really had that level of success and didn't have an in beforehand. I know people love to say Tarantino. I love Tarantino. But he had a friend who knew Harvey Keitel, and that's how Reservoir Dogs got financed. A lot of people don't know, like, Kevin had no one. Robert Rodriguez had no one. And those 90s, those early to mid 90s filmmakers are kind of the last action heroes to me. You know, when the early 2000s and then streaming kind of came along, and, you know, we don't really see as much of that getting made anymore. But yeah, I would say those two.
I'm not even sure you can answer this question because I don't know if you read a lot of books. What's your favorite book?
Oh, no, I do. Oh, man. That is a really interesting question. I don't really know if it's my favorite because I've read a lot of books that I've loved over the years. I really enjoy J.D. Salinger, both his short fiction and his novels. So Catcher in the Rye, I'm really partial to Kill a Mockingbird. I really love, Oscar Wilde's The Importance of Being Earnest, like is another one that just kind of just, so like there's a lot of, you know, what period are we talking about? Are we talking about funny books, sad books? But yeah, those are some immediate ones that kind of jump out at me.
Okay. Because I think you're a cinephile, one film nobody watches, you always recommend to them.
Oh, man, there's so many. There's so many. One of my favorites to tell people about is a little scene Richard Linklater movie he made called Tape. And it's an adaptation of an off-Broadway play. Exactly.
I've not seen it.
Ethan Hawke, Uma Thurman, and Robert Sean Leonard. And it's brilliant. If you haven't seen it, I'd highly recommend it. The other one that I'll say, and it's a bigger project, but a lot of people still haven't seen it. The Lonely Island made a movie called Pop Star, Never Stop, Never Stopping.
Oh, good.
It's hilarious, and nobody I know has seen it.
I have. You have. I have seen it.
Yeah. If you're looking for a really fun movie, I would highly recommend checking that out if you haven't seen it. Those guys came into their own in such a big way there. It is a hysterically funny movie from start to finish, and it did not get the love and attention it deserved. So I'll give you drama and comedy.
Perfect. Before I let you go, last thing, you got to tell everybody where they can find your movie.
Okay, so we're on Amazon and Tubi and Plex and Distro TV, so we're in a whole bunch of other places.
Hold on, where did you send me to watch it? Was it Plex?
Tubi. I sent you Tubi, yeah.
Okay, I can't remember. I did watch it.
Yeah, no, so we're on Tubi. It's probably the easiest one, but Amazon, a whole bunch of other places. You can go to the film's IMDb page and check it out. Also, if you are in New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, that tri-state area, we are doing a screening of the film. It is a one-night-only event at Kevin Smith's Smod Castle Theater on Saturday, August 12th at 8 p.m. I will be in attendance. So if you're local to that area and want to see a fun indie comedy, please come check us out. The tickets are only $15. And, you know, if you have the chance to come out and support a fun indie film, it would really mean a lot to me and the rest of the people that worked on this.
Thank you for your time and have a great evening.
You too. Take care, Simon.
Hey, thanks for listening to that interview with Simon. Could you please rate and review us on iTunes and Spotify? And if you have any extra change, feel free to send it to us at PayPal. And that's extrafeatures@gmail.com on PayPal. Thank you. Bye.